Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on dry eye disease. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Marjan Farid, Behram Makhbarah, and John Hovhannisian review the role of neuromodulation and the pathogenesis of dry eye disease. Additionally, the expert panel presents a case study of the typical patient presenting with dry eye and reviews the current and newly available treatment options. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Alcon Vision. To start, Dr. Hovhannisian talks about the role of neuromodulation in dry eye disease.
Today's subject actually is a really pretty simple concept to think in terms of the lacrimal functional unit in managing dry eye disease. Neuromodulation is kind of an interesting subject that arises in a number of different fields in medicine. Basically, the idea is to stimulate nerves to affect a physiologic change. This can be either neuronal cells or glial cells. We affect either the cells, their health, or their activity. And it may be a stimulus that is pharmacologic. It may be a stimulus that's electrical or magnetic. But we're looking at specific targets with each of these. And neurostimulation devices have included electrodes applied to the brain or spinal cord or peripheral nerves. And some of the top the targets of these are pretty impressive. From deep brain stimulation used for spasmodic movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, for dystonia, to depression. Magnetic stimulation has been used for that application. Spinal cord stimulation for a variety of indications that are listed here, bladder dysfunction, Tourette's syndrome, epilepsy, and sacral nerve stimulation as well. So all of these have been targets that have been used. So this is a longstanding I'd say emergingly understood field in medicine, different parts of the body. So ours is obviously strictly above the neck, and it targets this important lacrimal functional unit where we target for dry eye disease. And so the lacrimal functional unit, for those who haven't been indoctrinated to this, there's been some discussion over the past few years, includes really every part of this neural feedback loop that that can potentially treat dry eye and leads to a healthy ocular surface. So main and accessory lacrimal glands that are part of the output, as are the meibomian glands, conjunctival goblet cells. I mean, it's really everything that is part of the lacrimal unit. But also we know that innervation is key to health and restoration of the surface epithelium. And so the eyelid function has a part of this lacrimal functional unit because it's a feedback loop that includes, although it starts with the trigeminal nerve, it involves the facial nerves and all the oculomotor nerves as well. So the lacrimal drainage system is involved, and then also the glandular and mucosal immune system. So all of the interconnecting innervation is involved. And all of us kind of need to know about this because it's important to some of the new therapies that we're seeing for dry eye.
Next, the expert panel discusses the role of thermoreceptors in dry eye.
Afferent neurons certainly play a role in this. And we know that there are obviously different types of receptors, including cold thermoreceptors. And this was new to me. I don't know if you knew this, but 15% of our corneal sensory neurons actually detect changes due to evaporation, but it's not the dryness that it's driving, but the change in temperature. That's a heat-absorbing process, evaporation is. And so there are also polymodal nociceptors that are activated by other noxious stimuli, so friction heat and chemical irritants, and mechanical receptors that get triggered when we have damage to epithelium, traumatic injury to the cornea, whether it's subclinical and just a drying surface or something else. So modulations of these transient receptor potential channels, or TRP modulation, is a logical target for dry eye treatment. And afferent neurons certainly play a role in this. And we know that there are obviously different types of receptors, including cold thermoreceptors. And this was new to me. I don't know if you knew this, but 15% of our corneal sensory neurons actually detect changes due to evaporation, but it's not the dryness that it's driving, but the change in temperature. That's a heat-absorbing process, evaporation is. And so there are also polymodal nociceptors that are activated by other noxious stimuli, so friction heat and chemical irritants, and mechanical receptors that get triggered when we have damage to epithelium, basically traumatic injury to the cornea, whether it's subclinical and just a drying surface or something else. So modulations of these transient receptor potential channels, or TRP modulation, is a logical target for dry eye treatment. And so it's a cold sensing receptor that's on the nerve endings and makes up about 15% of our receptors. And this triggers ion channels that act as cellular sensors. And there are a whole bunch of subtypes, but TRPM8 is where we're paying our attention today. So these exist in various places on the surface of the eye, but you can see both in the eyelid and on the cornea, we have these TRPM8 receptors.
You know, these TRP channels, recently a lot of research and investigation on these other ones that were, possible responses, TRPV1, TRPA1, these detect, you know, because a lot of people say, well, can I sniff a chili pepper? That makes me tear. Or, do something noxious to the ocular surface? That's going to make me tear. But that's triggering these other receptors that produce reflex tears.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference. And that's why I think TRPM8 specifically is not a nociceptor. It's different.
So that's really relevant to the part of the discussion we'll get into as well. So temperature on the ocular surface is something that we're also beginning to understand a little bit better. So just after a blink, it is a little less than body temperature, about 34, 35 degrees Celsius. But there's a meaningful drop between blinks in the ocular surface temperature, we think due to evaporation. And that is one of the triggers for the TRPM8 receptor to stimulate this lacrimal functional unit. And so even very small temperature changes, 0.05 of a degree centigrade, can activate these cold receptors. Now menthol, which is related to a product we're going to talk about in a little bit, is also a TRPM agonist. The problem with menthol is that, like other sort of noxious stimulants, like the chili pepper, it is not easy to tolerate and also triggers reflex tearing. So a certain basal tearing is what we want, but we don't want to see a lot of reflex tearing with any therapy that we take. So having a more targeted therapy is a logical approach for us.
Now Dr. Magpura reviews a case study of a typical patient presenting with dry eye.
Let's introduce this topic by going through a case. And this is this situation or some form of it is something that comes up in our office all the time. So we have a 57-year-old woman. She'll come into the office complaining of significant photophobia, blurry vision, and she works as an administrative assistant. And really the big issue for her is her symptoms are preventing her from reading, from working on the computer for long hours. And I don't know about you guys, but I get this request all the time, and she's coming in asking for disability paperwork to be filled out. And, you know, honestly, earlier on, I'm like, oh, these individuals are just looking for a way out of work. But really, you know, imagine if, you know, your livelihood depends on looking at the computer and your symptoms are just so irritating and debilitating that you can't do that. So I do think it is a legitimate disability. And she's trying, right? Now, is she doing the right things? That's to be determined. But she's using over-the-counter preserved artificial tears every 1 to 2 hours, and it's not helping. She's a type 1 diabetic. And, you know, like a lot of our dry eye patients, this is starting to affect her mental health, like I was alluding to. And her biggest worry is she feels like she just can't go on with her job anymore, and she's worried about her livelihood, she's worried about providing for her family. So you feel bad for these patients, I really do. So let's talk about, you know, some of her risk factors when it comes to dry eye. So, you know, she is the classic dry eye patient, so she's your post-menopausal female. Her lifestyle, certainly contributing. We're all on digital media nowadays, but, you know, even as physicians, we're on the computer all day. That's all we do, right? We type and we look at the screen. She's probably not going about treating her dry eye in the way we'd recommend because she's using a preserved artificial tear, so possible BAK toxicity. You know, this comes up you know, I staff a bunch of residents at Wills, and you know, that the treatment that they always recommend first is aggressive preservative-free artificial tears. One, I don't know what aggressive artificial, like, you know, they squeeze really hard to get it into the eye. But, you know, anytime someone comes in and we're recommending use a even a preservative-free tear every 1 to 2 hours, I mean, what do you guys think about that?
I think you know, what I call it is dishpan eyes. Like, you're washing away all the oils and the good stuff. Right. You're almost like having a opposite effect.
It's almost counterproductive, right? You're washing away the mucins. You're washing away what's supposed to be there. You're just diluting the good stuff that's there too, right? So I never think, if anyone is dependent on artificial tears that frequently, they really should be on something else, right? And then, of course, she's type 1 diabetic, so maybe is there a neurotrophic component here? Likely. So we look at her at the slit lamp. Visual acuity with correction, she's 20/40. So again, this is an otherwise healthy 57-year-old. You know, these patients should be seeing 20/20, and she's not. You look at the cornea, you analyze the ocular surface. Fluorescein staining is my go-to. And she's got, you know, moderate to severe fluorescein staining of her cornea. Her tear breakup time is decreased, so it's about 5 to 6 seconds. And, you know, you look at the eyelids, and she has a component of meibomian gland dysfunction. You know, we'll do a tear film osmolarity analysis, and she's got an elevated tear osmolarity of 310 in the right eye, 315 in the left. Not terribly elevated, but elevated. So the question is, you know, what do you treat first? And this is kind of our classic dry eye patient, right? They don't come in a vacuum. It's not just one component. This is a multifactorial disease. So do we treat tear volume? Do we treat the inflammation? Do we treat the lids? Do we want to improve the quality of tears? And really the answer here is you have to treat it all, and you have to treat all of the layers in order to get that tear film restored to a healthy tear film.
In this segment, the expert panel discusses the DUCE 2 treatment recommendations and some of the evidence regarding currently available treatment options.
If you look at the DUCE 2 treatment recommendations, this is considered the gold standard. And this is, I think, what most of us practice. So in someone that comes in with mild dry eye, we start with step one, which is patient education, maybe modification of environmental factors, you know, take breaks on the computer, use a humidifier at home, start ocular lubricants, ideally preservative-free, you know, lid hygiene with lid wipes or maybe hypochlorous acid spray, and then warm compresses. You know, warm compresses cannot be understated how important that is. And then step two, you know, if someone is dependent on that artificial tear, like I was saying, and I wouldn't say every 1 to 2 hours. I would say if someone needs to use a tear more than 2 or 3 times a day, well, then treatment should be escalated. And traditionally what we would do is we would escalate them to anti-inflammatory therapy, and that includes, you know, corticosteroids or our immunomodulators like cyclosporin or lifitegrast. So let's look at how do these traditional therapies work? So in order to do this, you know, the best way is to look at large literature reviews or a Cochrane review is a very convenient way to do that. And what a Cochrane review is it's an analysis of a large number of clinical trials. So this particular Cochrane review looked at topical steroid use for the treatment of dry eye. It was 22 randomized controlled trials that had over 4,100 patients enrolled across all of the studies. And what they concluded is that steroids probably provide a small to moderate degree of symptom relief beyond lubricants. I'd agree with that. It concludes that steroids may provide a small to moderate degree of symptom relief compared to cyclosporin A. I'd probably agree with that too. But the key is steroids, they're meant to be short-term treatments, right? You can't generally be on a steroid long-term because, and the Cochrane Review agreed, steroids may increase the risk of IOP and cataract formation compared to lubricants, right? So that's the reason we generally try to avoid keeping our patients on steroids as a long-term treatment for dry eye. So then what about our long-term treatments? So that's kind of where the immunomodulators come in, right? And kind of the original was cyclosporin, and there was another Cochrane review that looked at 30 randomized controlled trials using cyclosporin for the treatment of dry eye. And the evidence for cyclosporin on its effect on the symptoms of dry eye, so ocular discomfort, and the signs, including corneal fluorescein staining, Schirmer score, and tear breakup, was inconsistent. And I think this is consistent with our clinical practice. Sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't work as well. And you know, based on this Cochrane review, it may not be that much different in certain situations compared to the vehicle or artificial tears. Other conclusions from this review were that there may be an increase in non-serious adverse events, specifically burning. I do think that cyclosporin, you know, does cause ocular surface burning in a fair amount of patients. And there is recent evidence that cyclosporin does increase the number of conjunctival goblet cells, which was kind of a great finding that was discovered. But the question is, you know, does that increase in mucus production translate to improved symptoms and signs of dry eye? And I think that is a little bit less clear. So that's kind of to be determined. We don't really know that for sure. So the other immunomodulator, lifitegrast, there was a recent literature review, it just came out this year, looking at six randomized clinical trials. And there was consensus that the effectiveness on the signs and symptoms of dry eye was there. However, when it was compared to cyclosporin, there really wasn't a clear advantage. So one didn't perform significantly better than the other. And this line is interesting. You know, one of the lines that were quoted from this review is, although most physicians were satisfied with lifitegrast and cyclosporin for the treatment of dry eye, they agreed that more therapeutic options are needed. And I think us as physicians would agree with that. And I also think that, you know, our patients would agree with that. You know, if you think about it, how many of your patients feel like their dry eye is adequately controlled?
You know, I'll tell you exactly the number that we found. We did a study, it was an informal study because we've been collecting data on patient feedback about their dry eye treatments for years, and based on about 600 patients, 80% of those taking cyclosporin had no idea if it was helping them.
Yeah.
And this is not to slam that drug. I think it's a terrific drug, which was the first of its kind, right? But it's not universally beneficial, and it's not a clear winner in all cases.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd like to echo that. You know, we're not here slamming cyclosporin or lifitegrast or steroids.
Steroids, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think they have a vital role still in the treatment of dry eye.
For sure.
But, you know, we do have to acknowledge that, you know, we're not there yet. You know, I think we need something else.
We need more mechanisms of action, and we need more targeted therapies. I think, you know, so, yeah, exactly, for inflammation, chronic inflammation, by all means, I love steroids. I love immunomodulators. I didn't say lacrimal functional unit.
I did. Oh. I did, yeah.
In a review of newer treatment options, the faculty start by discussing varenicline, which is available as a nasal spray.
All right, so let's talk about some of the newer therapies out there, right? So varenicline, we mentioned this earlier. This is a nasal spray. It's a preservative-free nasal spray that stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system by targeting nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on the trigeminal nerve.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And these nicotinic acetylcholine receptors stimulate the lacrimal functional unit, and this produces that healthy basal tear that we want. So this was studied in a randomized controlled clinical trial, onset 2, and when compared to a vehicle group, the varenicline group had a statistically significant number of patients that had a increase in Schirmer score greater than 10 millimeters at the 4-week mark. And that is kind of the primary endpoint that a lot of dry eye studies use, is percentage of patients that have an increase in Schirmer's greater than 10 millimeters. So it's indicating increased tear production. So, you know, varenicline met that primary endpoint. As a result, we have an FDA-approved product. It's a nasal spray, and with nasal sprays, there are nasal side effects, right? So the most common AEs reported with this medication were mild and non-ocular, but some patients found them annoying. Sneezing, cold, sneezing, cough, throat irritation, and installation site irritation. So kind of the nose doesn't feel great. So it is technique dependent. You know, some patients like it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, those that don't want to use an eye drop, but, you know, there is this kind of barrier of, you know, I'm going to spray something in my nose to treat my dry eye. And it's just, there's a little bit to get beyond to get patients to buy into that sometimes. What else? So this is maybe something that's a little bit less known. It's been around for about 5 years now. It's external neurostimulation. So it's a device that you place on the outside of your nose. It's called the iTier 100. And what it does is it stimulates the external nasal nerve. This has, the data behind this is not as robust, so we don't really have a randomized controlled clinical trial. What we have is a multi-center open label, single arm trial, so it was not, you know, studied against a control or a vehicle. What they looked at was the change in Schirmer score compared to pre-stimulation to post-stimulation, and this was kind of dubbed the Schirmer Index. And that was the primary endpoint at day 30, and the secondary endpoint was the symptoms of dry eye measured using the OSDI. And at day 30, there was an increase in Schirmer. So the Schirmer index was 9.4 millimeters of mercury, 9.4 millimeters. And the OSDI improved by about 14.4. So the signs increased tear production and symptoms, decreased OSDI, did improve with this device. But
all right, yeah,
is there something else?
Finally, the expert panel discusses Acoltremon, which is a newly approved ophthalmic solution for the treatment of dry eye. This is a first-in-class TRPM8 receptor agonist that works by stimulating corneal sensory nerves to rapidly increase natural tear production. Please note that at the time of this recording, Acoltremon has not yet been approved by the FDA. However, it was approved in May of 2025.
Comfort that's hard to differentiate from dry eye for patients, it can be really helpful to stay in the conjunctiva, so I completely agree.
Absolutely. So, no, I found this compelling because we don't see this often when we're looking at new products for treatment of dry eye disease. Finally, let's go into the safety profile. So they pooled all of the safety from actually all three of their studies, patients that had the Acoltremon, and the most common ocular treatment adverse event was instillation site burning or stinging with incidence of 51%. Of the subjects who did report this, 98% of them reported as mild, and only two subjects from, and this was over, if you look at just COMET 213, there's over 460 patients, but I think they also included COMET 1 in this. So it was out of a large group of patients, two patients ended up discontinuing. Now, burning and stinging was the only option in terms of, because it was more of a multiple choice question. And what is interesting to me is that this drop is going to affect the nerves of the cornea. Yeah. And what does that translate into a sensation? And I don't know the answer to this. I haven't put this on my eye, but it's something interesting to think about.
Yeah, you know, it's something that hopefully when we have access to this product, when it's commercialized, when thousands and thousands of people start to use it, we'll be able to better characterize what is this feeling. Because when you see these numbers, you're like, whoa, 53%. Have this, but then you look deeper into it, it's generally mild, and very rarely do patients feel like it's bad enough that they need to stop using the medication. So when you have this sort of data, I think it's important to acknowledge it, and you know, if we have the opportunity to prescribe it, counsel our patients that, hey, look, you may feel this, and what this is, you know, we'll figure that out. But just to let them know that, look, you may feel something, it doesn't mean that anything's wrong. It doesn't mean that you should stop it. And I think that goes a long way, just to spend that like 5 seconds and just let them know that this is probably going to happen.
And if you look at the alternatives with cyclosporin, with lefitograss is a 5% concentration of drug in the bottle. You feel that when you put it in your eye. If you've put lefitograss in, you know it. Mm-hmm. And same with cyclosporin. It's a very difficult drug to formulate because of its lack of water solubility. And so it's not surprising to see a sensation with this drug that is designed to create a sensation. I think probably if this study had to be repeated, it would, you know, we'd delve a little bit more into defining what those symptoms are that they're calling stinging. Right. So we understand it as a cold sensation or a soothing sensation or something, because it could also be a positive. So something we'll need to learn from and maybe educate patients on, but certainly not something that would cause me to have caution in using the drug. I'm still very eager to use it.
Yeah, and a lot of our treatments, really, it's all about, as you said, with the varenicline spray, it's all about educating patients on expectations and correct use and all of this. So, you know, that goes for any treatments in the dry eye disease space, for sure. But, you know, I'm excited that we are expanding our toolbox in this space. And, you know, and we're going to see more coming on the market. Eric Donenfeld gave an amazing talk about things upcoming in this.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.